The following is part of the A1-Wrestling.com podcast family.
Greetings once again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville and the host of the Geekville podcast. We got a huge show for you this week, folks, and we don't really want to waste much time getting into it. We are going to talk some news. There's been some casting news in the world of Star Wars and Flash, as well as the announcement of Red Dead Redemption 2. But the meat of this show is going to focus back into the Trek world, and I got kind of a at least in my mind, an all-star cast for you, making his regular appearance here in the Geekville podcast from the asylum in South Kakalaki, the Crazy Train himself, Mr. Jonathan Bullock.
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of talk about, so let's get to it.
And I do have two returning guests. One, if you listen to our sister show, Examining the Doctor, you've heard this man's voice on many occasions. And I think just about every episode we've done of Examining the Doctor, with the exceptions of the ones I've done solo, from England and the PropStop.com's Mark Short.
Hi, folks. Yeah, we've got some meat in Noron here, so let's get Noron.
I was telling these guys off the air, you know, Mark is kind of like my mentor to Doctor Who of sorts. And the next man I'm going to introduce, he's kind of my mentor for Star Trek, and he was last heard on our two-part History of Star Trek episode. And that is, of course, from Seattle, Will Mortal.
Hey, Seth. Nice to be back. Nice to talk to you guys again.
So, without further ado, let's get into the news part of the show.
This week in Geek News.
Probably the biggest thing to hit is in the geek world this week has been the casting of the young Lando Calrissian in the as-yet-unnamed young Han Solo movie. And it doesn't get much more official than this because it's actually on StarWars.com. That is that Donald Glover cast as young Lando Calrissian in an upcoming Han Solo Star Wars standalone film. And I'm sure Donald Glover really needs no introduction to most of our listeners. He's definitely made a name for himself on TV with Community, and he was also a fan favorite to play the Miles Morales incarnation of Spider-Man if they were ever to do a Miles Morales Spider-Man movie. So, Train, I'll throw to you first because I had to pick one. So, your thoughts? Your thoughts on Donald Glover as a young Lando Calrissian?
I'm fine with that. You know, I'm a lover of the Lando Calrissian character in general, and so I've been quite open on this podcast about I'm not one who's looking super excited to these standalone films, but at the same time, a young Han Solo and a young Lando, that's two pretty pimp dudes. I'm down with that. So. You know, one thing I want to know, maybe anybody can answer this. I don't know much about Donald Glover except for his TV work. Is he related to Danny Glover at all?
No, he's actually not.
Okay.
I looked that up before.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure you can understand why I would wonder that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm down with that. I mean, I haven't read as much of the expanded universe as you have, Xandrax, and some of the other guests we have here. So I'm not as familiar with Lando's backstory. So I'll be interested to see it, and I'm down with that.
And Will, I take it you're in agreement?
Yeah, so I know Donald Glover quite well. I'm a huge, obsessed fan of Community. Watched it all six seasons. I think, Seth, you and I tried to get you into it before. It's pretty great. That show spans so many genres and has so many, like, nudge-nudge, wink-wink episodes about stuff. I mean, there's two episodes dedicated to blanket forts versus pillow forts. There's a whole episode on the floor is lava. Like, there's so many, like, there's, like, three or four paintball episodes, and in one of them they do an entire Star Wars theme where Troy, played by Donald Glover's best friend Abed, is actually the Han Solo character, and Troy kind of plays, or Donald Glover plays a bit of a Lando Calrissian at various times in that episode. So when I heard that they were casting this, I agree with Train. I'm not as big on these standalone movies, but that actually made me quite excited. I think he'll absolutely knock the role out of the park.
All right, Mark, you get final say in the Donald Glover talk.
Well, I'm excited, you know, ever since I owned my Lando action figure when Empire came out. I just wonder, though, in the deal, when he was working out his deal, maybe Donald said, like, you know, oh, I love Star Wars, I'd love to be in your movie. And then they said, well, we'll give you $50,000 every time you appear in the movie. So as he's walking away, I can only imagine that he quoted the original Lando and probably said, this deal is getting worse all the time. But now I'm excited about that. Great actor, and I'm sure the Marvel people will be really mad because they probably won't be able to get him to be something down the road from now on because he'll be too busy doing Star Wars.
And as fate would have it, he actually is appearing in Spider-Man Homecoming. He's just obviously not being Spider-Man. So we're all in agreement. Donald Glover, great choice. I am curious what Billy Dee's thoughts on it are, because, you know, those are some pretty pimp shoes to fill.
Am I the only one hoping that there's maybe this movie's in flashback so we get to see a modern-day Billy Dee reminisce? Just for, you know, 30 seconds on screen, you know? Just
works every time.
Am I the only one that wants Lobot to come back? That's the real question.
It's Billy Dee. Anytime I can see Billy Dee, I'm down with that.
Billy Dee, awesome. Billy Dee, Billy Dee.
Billy Dee Williams.
And I'm not even a female, so there you go, right?
All right, the next piece of news hit the a couple days ago, and it's really no surprise knowing the history of the show, we're talking about The Flash, but Mark Hamill is going to be making his third appearance on the show. And he, of course, appeared the previous two seasons as the Trickster. There's a TV Web article that is going to be linked in the show notes at geekvilleradio.com, and it links some images from Twitter, and it's Mark Hamill with his face painted white. He's got really red lips and colored hair and a very loud suit. And he's standing next to John Wesley Shipp's Jay Garrick. So there's speculation that is Mark Hamill actually playing a different incarnation of the Joker, or is this just a trickster homage to the Joker? Mark, I'll ask you, because you're actually looking at the same image I am.
Yeah, I'm thinking this is a homage or a joke on the fans, or, you know, to me, I'm not a big fan of these TV shows coming to TV, but I have to say, I have to eat my words with the Tyler Hoechner or Holchner guy. My goodness me, that first two episodes of Supergirl were so watchable, and it just proves, you know, the ratings doubled on it on CW. Everybody said nothing but good things about Tyler being great Clark Kent, great Superman. So certainly I'm a viewer now every time they bring good stuff back to TV. And, you know, just like they need to bring Jerome back for Gotham, because I thought he was a great Joker, and I still believe that he's going to be the Joker in Gotham, even though I haven't hardly watched any of it. This is an example of something that's going to bring me in to watch The Flash again, because Mark Hamill as a Joker in real time is just awesome.
All right, Will, your thoughts of Mark Hamill return of the Flash, and if he is playing the Trickster or the Joker, does it matter to you?
Yeah, no, I think he's going to play the Trickster. I was a big fan of the John Wesley Shipp series from, I believe, the late 80s, though it could have been early 90s. I don't remember quite offhand, but I think that's what it's going to be. And Mark Hamill, great voice for the Joker, and, you know, I'm excited about it. You know, I do watch all the CW shows, except for the fact that I don't have cable, and I don't get it over the air, so I'm generally a season behind watching it on Netflix. So,
all right, Train, you get the last word on Mark Hamill in Flash, and I know you watch the show as well. So,
oh, you know, I like the Trickster character, and I love what he brings to it. So, I don't care if it's the Joker or it's the Trickster. Personal opinion, it's probably the Trickster. Might be a different. Obviously, if they're showing Jay Garrick in the picture, it's probably Earth 2.
Earth 3.
Earth 3, sorry, yeah. So, but then again, because you are dealing with Flash and parallel dimensions, you don't know, and that poses a question I'll leave our listeners with. They can think about this. Is this a possible another addition to this Legion of Doom we know is coming in this universe? We've already got Reverse Flash. We already have Damian Dark. We know that Merlin is coming back because Barrowman signed all four shows. I wouldn't mind seeing a Mark Hamill as a Joker or a Trickster in with that little group. Just food for thought.
And we know we're getting Captain Cold at some point, and he, I believe Wentworth Miller is also signed for all four shows, so he's probably going to be part of that big crossover.
Yep. So you never know. I mean, it gets more intriguing, making that four-way crossover come in mid-season even more and more enticing, isn't it?
Yeah, there's one other image that hit Twitter as well that is Mark Hamill with a kind of a furry coat, but he's clearly brandishing one of those gangster-style Tommy guns with the drum magazine.
And trying not to look like Heath Ledger.
Is he eating a Twizzler?
Well, maybe he's got some in the bag he's holding. I don't know.
That was so creepy, man.
I don't know, but I think he's going to show us a magic trick. Oh, pencil in the head.
It's gone.
The last piece of news that we're going to talk about, Train, I'm going to let you have center stage because I know you've been following this for quite some time. It's one of your favorite games. We finally got the announcement of Red Dead Redemption 2 from Rockstar Games, a little one-minute trailer that really didn't show us much other than some nice scenery. So your thoughts on, first off, that we're finally officially getting Red Dead Redemption 2, that it's a year off, and you know maybe some of our listeners who might not be the biggest gamers kind of set the stage for what this means.
Oh, okay. Redemption was a huge seller. At the time, it was developed in 2009. It was the most expensive game ever made. It was made by Rockstar Games, which is the same company and developers that make the Grand Theft Auto franchise. And it was a spiritual successor to an earlier game from like 2004 called Red Dead Revolver that didn't nearly have the fan following that Red Dead Redemption had. Ever since Red Dead Redemption came out, all of the ardent fan bases wanted to know there's going to be a sequel. And Rockstar has kind of skirted around that issue for years, mostly because they've been involved with GTA 5 and other projects. But there were a lot of fan things coming out. Small things started to leak over the last year. Supposed map of what the new world's going to look like. A possible title that it was going to be a prequel to Red Dead Redemption. Well, we finally got all that this week. It started on Monday when Rockstar finally teased us by changing their Reddit and Twitch accounts and their page on their Facebook to a old school Rockstar logo with a completely red background. And if you played the game, you knew that tint, that particular shade of red was the background red for the load screens on Red Dead Redemption. So you're like, aha, it's coming. And then on Tuesday, they teased us even more by changing it from that to a picture of seven silhouetted cowboys walking towards the screen against the backdrop of a setting sun. So it became obvious that this was going to be Red Dead Redemption 2. On Wednesday, or late Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning, they did announce that Red Dead Redemption 2 was coming in fall of 2017, and there would be a teaser trailer on Thursday. So that answered one question. We wondered, was it going to be called Red Dead something else with an R? There was a lot of fans thinking Retribution or whatnot, but the official name is going to be Red Dead Redemption 2. And then on Thursday, it dropped. Like you said, it was a minute long. There's not a lot to talk about. There's no gameplay in it whatsoever. It just seems to be Rockstar trying to show you what the feel and the look of the game is going to be. A lot of cowboys, a lot of ranchers. The biggest thing to hardcore fans like me that stood out was, one, it looks definitely like it's a different place in America than the setting of Red Dead Redemption. It's more mountainous. There's no desert scenes, more water. One of the things that everybody hated about Red Dead Redemption was the main protagonist, John Marston, pretty much instantly died as soon as you walked into water over his chest because he couldn't swim. And there are scenes of people, of characters canoeing in lots of water. So we're thinking maybe there'll be some, that will be removed in this game.
It also looked like it was a few years later because just judging by the setting and the you know the technology and stuff that what little bit we saw, like it's more early 20th century.
Yeah, that Red Dead Redemption is 1911 to 1914, and I'm thinking that this has got to be earlier than that. So the prequel theory was right because they show one scene has a big herd of buffalo. Well, the buffalo were dying by 1911, and that's part of the original game is if you kill all the buffalo in the game, you get an achievement called Manifest Destiny, and they don't respawn like the other animals. Whereas this herd's much bigger than the herd, so I'm thinking it is earlier. Some of the things don't look as worn, like the stagecoach and the storefronts, so I'm thinking probably 1885, 1890, which would make sense.
More of a classic Western era.
Right, right. And the other thing that really stuck out to a lot of fans was one of the scenes is very quick, One of the characters is dual-wielding pistols, which was something that we didn't get to do in the last game. Dual-wield weapons. So I think everybody's hopeful that that will come with the new gen and the technological breakthroughs. So everybody's excited, but we got a year to wait. And I'm pretty sure as things go on, we'll get more gameplay trailers and a little bit more about the story will leak out. We'll get verified for sure from Rockstar if that leaked map is legit, which from the look of the trailer, it is. So now it's just hurry up and wait. That's about all you can do now.
Well, the big question is, though, are they going to make that release date?
I think they will. I don't.
Well, they haven't tended to in the past, have they? This is Rockstar we're talking about.
This is true. Which is also smart. They hedged their bets by just saying fall 2017.
That's a long time. Fall is a long time. That's a good 4 or 5 months that they've got to change. And then that'll be fall of 2018.
Right. But what I'm saying is they didn't say like October 2000. They didn't pigeonhole themselves into a 31-day period. So you're right, though. You're totally right. Rockstar is notorious for not. I think that if you follow Rockstar, expanding that out, they've kind of cut back on what they've been doing with GTA 5 Online, which has been their big money maker the last few years. So I'm hopeful that the reason that this announcement is coming and it seems to coincide with the falling back on that is because they're actually taking people off of support team off of the GTA 5 and going, we need you on this new project because we've got to get it out in a year.
Well, it wasn't that. It was the people spending all their money over the last year. They had all that money from the games and they needed to go out and buy at least 50 Ferraris, you know?
A couple private jets.
And they earn everything that they made from that game. You know, all of the people, you know, who did well off that, they really earned it. So if they wanted a year off, then damn it, they can have their year off.
Yeah, and in speculation, when you bring up GTA 5 and all the money they made off of it, a lot of fans are hoping of this franchise that maybe some of the things they got right and learned from GTA 5 as a developer will be applied to this game, like multiple protagonists that you can trade off during the middle of the story, and a more because this is going to be dealing more with, we know that Wild West and like outlaw gangs. The idea that you have from GTA 5 of heists, where you can get together with a bunch of friends as a team and cooperatively, like maybe rob a stagecoach or a train or something, those are things we're hoping for. But we don't know.
We're going to rob you. We're going to rob a train.
I mean, you're not going to rob me. I'm like, here, take my money, you know? I'm not.
Well, it's perfect timing, isn't it? Because Westworld, which I actually think is bloody fantastic, is hot. You know, Magnificent Seven came out, was hot. I think that it's going to catch the tail end of this interest in Westerns that wasn't there maybe a few years ago when Wild Wild West was out. Not that Wild Wild West was any good, but...
You bring that up, you know, and isn't it intriguing that the teaser that they showed with the Cowboys and then in this the trailer is seven outlaws riding together on horseback.
Oh, I thought it was a giant spider coming over a cliff.
Wink, wink.
And isn't that cool, by the way, that Kevin Smith is going to be doing, is it, you know, the Death of Superman or the Death of Supergirl episode, which instantly, Supergirl Lives, which instantly made me think that all the things in his script he gave to these other guys because he's going to direct it. So we would have, you know, Supergirl being attacked by the polar bear, Supergirl being attacked by Metallo, Supergirl, you know, being attacked by maybe like a rabid penguin. I mean, this is just dream stuff for Kevin Smith, as long as, you know, he doesn't like put stupid things in it like sentient sausages from his last epic.
You had me at polar bears.
I had you at sentient sausages. I know I did. Okay, so anything else, Train, or we'll be moving on to the meat of the episode?
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. John Marston is the most unique, complex, and well-fleshed-out original character I've ever seen in a video game, except for maybe Master Chief from Halo series.
And that's John Marston, not James Marston from Westworld.
don't curse John Marston like that.
All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to jump from the Old West into Star Trek. I don't know how many other podcasts do that, but we're going to talk the Star Trek Axanar controversy. It's why I brought my all-star cast together, and we're going to dive back into the Star Trek world when we come back.
This is Norco from the A1 Podcast reminding you, if you enjoy listening to Seth on the Geekville Podcast, listen to him again on our regular podcast, A1 Podcast. Listen to every week on Tuesdays, the A1 Podcast, where wrestling and pop culture collide.
You never know who's going to show up on the A1 Podcast.
This is Mr. Saturday Night Michael Barrett.
This is Joe Dombrowski, the official voice of Prime Wrestling TV.
What's up, all you stars and studs? This is former WWE diva Maria Kanellis and current First Lady of Ring of Honor.
This is Aaron McGuire, color commentator extraordinaire.
Hey, everybody, this is Jock Sampson, the Appalachian Outlaw, and you're listening to the A1 Podcast, baby. Get tough.
The A1 Podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, or at A1-Wrestling.com.
This is the only podcast that's Jimmy Rave approved.
Looking for a podcast that talks video gaming? A show that has something for both classic and current gen gamers alike? Well, then look no further.
You Just Got Fragged.
YouJustGotFragged.com hosts the You Just Got Fragged podcast, news and commentary on the world of gaming, likes, gripes, top 10 lists, and more. That's YouJustGotFragged.com. Part of the A1-Wrestling.com podcast family.
You just got fragged.
Attention all Time Lords and Ladies. This message is being sent by the order of Lady President Romana and the High Council of Gallifrey. Geekville presents Examining the Doctor, a weekly commentary on Doctor Who stories, both classic and new. From Hartnell to Capaldi, Examining the Doctor keeps you both informed and entertained. That's Geekville Presents Examining the Doctor, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at A1-Wrestling.com.
All right, we are back here at the Geekville Podcast, and we are diving into it's a controversy that's been going back for approximately about a year. I believe the lawsuit was filed in December of last year. And that is the controversy over I would still call it a fan film, because it's obviously not anything officially endorsed by Paramount or CBS, but the Star Trek Axanar, which you can see the 20-minute prelude to Axanar film, which is shot like almost like a Discovery Channel documentary. I'll set it up. With my opinion, maybe I get, and Will, it's why I have you on the show, because maybe you can correct me where I'm wrong. But it's set about 20 years before the classic series, and it chronicles the war between the Federation and the Klingons. Does that sound right about the time frame?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay, and there are some well-known actors in it: Richard Hatch, Gary Graham, of sorts. But Mark, I'm going to let you lead in here, because you've been following this for a long time. You've had an interest in it. So if we have any listeners who aren't aware of the controversy, the lawsuit going on, run with how this got going and where it kind of stands.
Well, first of all, it's pretty complicated. So we're going to be posting some links on the site that will direct you to different areas. And what this is really about is, I guess, letting you guys make your own mind up. We'll try and be factual about it, but at the end of the day, what you have is two competing teams, a number of people who like the idea of Axanar, a load of people who don't. And it really centers around the ideas of IP today, and that means, you know, what it is to own something. Most companies, as we know, like in this case Paramount and CBS, they own Star Trek. They own everything to do with it, from the insignia, from the Enterprise, the shape of what it looks like. And the idea being that when Axanar came about, they were taking items that belonged to CBS, imagery, maybe sound effects, characters, and they were trying to use them in a fan film. But what seems to have been the problem for CBS and Paramount and the opposing team of thinkers, of which I kind of think I'm in the middle, I kind of see the benefits of both sides. But isn't that the problem with Axanar? The whole case is like two sets of people, the ones who do love it and the ones who hate it. The idea of IP infringement, the idea of making money from something that you don't own. And I kind of see myself as being in the middle. I don't really have a bone in this race, but I've been reading about it ever since, you know, Alec started off in business with PropWorks, which was a movie prop company that he set up. Did some fantastic auctions with Battlestar Galactica and Marvel and Kevin Smith. I bought stuff from his organization. Then, for want of another word, the company went bankrupt. They ended up owing MGM Studios, who did Stargate with PropWorks, you know, $300,000-$400,000. And it was a huge hole in the prop community. Those auctions had been running for 2 or 3 years, on and off. And suddenly a lot of companies that dealt with the fans were kind of unsure about, you know, taking on a fan to do movie prop auctions because of what had happened with MGM not getting paid, you know, $300,000 or $400,000. So then Alec, I guess, had talked to Richard Hatch about the idea of doing a Battlestar Galactica fan film, which Richard Hatch had been trying to get off the ground for many, many, many years. And then came up with, you know, the Axanar, which, of course, they did the prelude to Axanar. It was a 2014 American fan-made short film. It wasn't really done professionally, but it looked professional. It was funded through Kickstarter with a production budget of what they were expecting to be $10,000, but they actually raised $101,000, and it went public in July 2014 at the San Diego Comic-Con. It was well-received. Set in the Star Trek universe, as you said, had Kate Vernon, Tony Todd, Richard Hatch, Gary Graham, J.G. Hertzler, all from Trek and Battlestar Galactica and various other series. And it was a documentary-style production surrounding the Battle of Axanar, as you say, a clash between the Federation and the Klingons. And they started work on it in 2010, soon after PropWorks' demise. And the idea was to use the Kickstarter platform to make this thing. They made it and shot it in 2 days and raised the money in by March the 31st, 2014. Reason why it looks so amazing is the visual effects were done by Tobias Ritzker and Tommy Kraft, who were, you know, worked in TV. Their stuff had been seen in movies. And basically, it's a talking heads thing with these amazing visuals of starships going through space. After they had done that, they decided they wanted to do the prelude to Axanar. And that, they went on Kickstarter and did something that raised, you know, $600,000, because George Takei saw it and pushed it. And the day he saw that, they made an extra $200,000, even though they were going to only try and make $100,000. And once they had started production, building the sets, they procured a studio, a warehouse that they made into a studio with green screen, and you know, they started building the sets in December of 2015, I believe. The lawsuit hit, and that's the point I'll end at the question you asked.
Because the way I see it as a fan, I think all four of us are more or less on the same page. And I have this disclaimer at the end of the show, but I'll say it here, that everybody's opinions here are their own. This is not representative of GeekvilleRadio.com or any company, Paramount, CBS, or anybody involved with the production or anybody involved with Star Trek. These are just four people talking. And I'll throw to you next, Will, but the way I see it, I'm all for fan films. There's some awesome fan films out there. One of the best ones we talked about a couple weeks ago of Gods and Men, which actually had Nichelle Nichols and Walter Koenig in it. But when you start coming around where you're making money with it, you know, that's where I think the problems really start. I like the George Lucas approach, the way that he had said about Star Wars fan films. And make all the fan films you want, just don't do it for money. So, Will, as the resident Star Trek expert, what's your opinion on this whole ordeal?
I'm going to look at this from sort of a sports point of view, Seth. I think when it comes to all of us or any of us who are sports fans, I know, Seth, you're a Cubs fan like myself. A lot of times when we have a downtrodden baseball team, football team, whatever you're into, hockey, basketball, there's always the fans that sit out there and go, man, it's a travesty. If I was running that team, I would have drafted differently. I would have signed this free agent. I would have hired this manager, and so on and so forth. And invariably, there's somebody in the room that calls that person out and sort of says, you know, well, then why aren't you running? And a lot of times, you know, we never get the opportunity. I don't necessarily think that many of us probably could run a sports franchise better than the people doing it, but of course there's going to be, I think, a reasonable percentage that perhaps could. I think when it comes to fandom and when we look at our favorite franchises, whether they be DC Comics, Marvel, Star Trek, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Firefly, I'm obsessed with Dune and Alien. So, you know, I think whenever it is you're looking at, a lot of us feel or become disenfranchised at times with how the franchise is going. And I know that we've talked Trek before about my unbelievable love for Star Trek, and I think part of loving Star Trek or franchise as large is actually disliking certain parts of it. And I think there's a lot of people that are, you know, very disenfranchised with the direction that Star Trek went under the JJ verse and are quite disappointed in Discovery. I could be projecting myself. I know we haven't seen Discovery, but it's just another interquel prequel that I don't think a lot of people want. And I think, you know, a lot of these things like Axanar started before, of course, things like Discovery were announced. But I think there's a lot of pent-up frustration with a lot of hardcore Trekkers that I talk to that we don't see why Trek isn't doing some very obvious things or going in pretty distinct directions. And I think there's a lot of creatives that are part of Trek. Like, if you're familiar with, was it Gabrielle Corner, the kid from the movie Trekkies that went on to do special effects for Battlestar Galactica, and I believe even worked on Trek as well. There's a lot of people that start out fans that make their way into writing, production, comics, whatever. So I think when you see things like Axanar, I think it's important to say, first and foremost, that I don't think that Axanar has any legal leg to stand on. You know, I can complain about patent or copyright law just like anyone else. However, it is what it is, and I don't know how they're ever going to get this thing off the ground. I can't see them having a case. I know they're challenging it. I think they're sort of hoping for a Hail Mary here where something unexpected happens and either Paramount settles with them or they win on some shocking, weird detail. I think that that's all they're holding. That's, of course, I'm not a lawyer. You're a scientist, but that's the way that I kind of think why they're still, they just don't want to give up. And I can understand that. That said, I think there's another issue with this, which is, I got to tell you, I think the reason that Paramount's so against it is because Prelude to Axanar is better than anything I've seen come out of Trek other than a couple episodes of Enterprise. I mean, I don't think that this is a franchise that Paramount's been managing particularly well. I think the fan base, who's creative, wants to do new things and wants to see the franchise go a different direction than what it's been going. And I think they've actually made something that's quite compelling. Granted, it doesn't have, you know, the $150 million special effects budget, but I don't think that's really been what Trek's about. And I think that they see something that is definitely threatening to newer stuff like Discovery, because if Axanar was very popular, it kind of caught a little bit of internet fire here, and Trek is very beloved, especially by a lot of the millennials with have fond memories of Next Generation, Voyager, Space Nine, whatever. You know, this could definitely, I think, dilute their Discovery brand, where people are like, I don't want this, I want more Axanar, or more things like Axanar. And I think that's the reason that we're getting sort of the pushback. I mean, obviously it's the month. You know, I'm a raging capitalist. I don't begrudge Paramount making money on anything. But I think there's a unique opportunity here that's somewhere in between that Paramount's really missing. You know, when music sales primarily went to the internet, iTunes, and of course, you know, the Google Play Store and Spotify, what have you, all the streaming services, there was a lot of pushback from the older record, you know, dinosaurs, really, that didn't like music being distributed this way. They didn't like you could buy one song at a time. And I think that, you know, really what we've ended up seeing is, you know, the Apple iTunes model being upheld as what consumers want. And I think there was an opportunity here for Star Trek to leap, I think, many of the other fandoms and really truthfully do something unique and new. And it would be the idea of letting perhaps fan films like this proceed. But whereas iTunes charges an artist, you know, anywhere between, I think, 3 to 20 cents, you know, on a dollar song, depending on how big a deal you are. I think there is an opportunity here for Paramount could have came back and, you know, said something like, we're going to create a, you know, some, this is the way I would do it if I was running out. I'd say we're going to create an alternate Trek universe, you know, haha. But basically a fan film. You can make whatever. You can sell them. You can do whatever you want. But you're going to have to register with us, license us. Perhaps we'll put a Trek store on StarTrek.com. And, you know, we're going to keep 80 cents out of every dollar that you make as profit. And we're going to officially let you license these, make money, and spin this out into not only a new revenue stream, but a new creative outlet for the fans. And I think that that would only grow the Star Trek fan base. I think it would excite the fans. And I think it would be a win-win-win for actors, win for studios, and win for creatives. This is really, you know, kind of the direction I wish would happen.
There's been a long history of fan films. There's been a long history of fan films. Even when I was a Doctor Who fan back in the 80s, people would grab a giant video recorder, put it on their shoulder, go out with their friends to the beach, and they'd make a small 15-minute episode of Doctor Who with all the terrible cuts in it and, you know, taking the theme music, overlaying it over the top. And, you know, we all, anybody who's 40 years old today probably had an experience of watching a fan film, maybe even at a convention or in your basement like that. But as technology has improved, fan films, suspect like Doctor Who, people from Real Time Pictures in the UK started making unit and wartime, some of those videos that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, where Keith Barnfather and Real Time Pictures would go to the writers, get permission to use the elements of Liz Sladen or Deborah Watling or the Yetis that the BBC didn't own, and then they would pay those writers and they would come up with Doctor Who style detective or action shorts, but they would still sell those for a profit and the BBC couldn't do anything about it. But I remember seeing my first really good Star Trek fan film with Star Trek Continues and the Corley and Mignola movies that came out for YouTube. And they're all done with no intention to make a profit, but they are easily something that you could put on CBS at 11 o'clock at night and say, this is real television. It's that good. And they deserve to be appreciated, but Axanar has affected the ability of those companies to make those not-for-profit films by Axanar basically saying, this is a professional production and we need to pay our people who make it to do it, because we need professionals to make it something that people would want to watch. And I think that's the thing that killed it for CBS Paramount. They were unwilling to accept, maybe not even that it was as good as what they could produce, but they were unwilling for other people to make money out of something that they owned.
I mean, the question is, though, is there a better disruptive, you know, new internet generation way to handle this rather than trying to go out there and block anything longer? And, you know, you might be able to tell me better. I think it was, 10 minutes long is that fan films are limited to, or 15 minutes?
15 minutes. It's 15 minutes. And the only reason that those fan film guidelines now exist is because Axanar asked many months ago that there be, Alec had actually said he preferred knowing what the rules were, because CBS would not commit to those plans. They just kept saying, we can't tell you what's right and what's wrong. But that's the same thing that's been dominating, you know, Doctor Who fans and Star Wars fans for a long time. They didn't know where they stood. So look at me, back in the 80s, when Doctor Who finished in 89, I had actually decided to get that camcorder on my shoulder, borrow someone's TARDIS that was professionally made, get a Dalek, use the character of Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer, and go and film something in 1991 in a quarry. Because my idea was, like, if the BBC doesn't want to do something with Doctor Who, I'm a fan, I want to. So I started writing the script, and it was one night I was sitting there, and I was so enthused. I had people involved who wanted to be involved in this fan film. And it suddenly came to me, after writing fanzines and publishing, you know, for 10 years, and after loving this thing that I love so much, Doctor Who, it wasn't up to me to make a fan film. It wasn't my right. I didn't own these things. And the only reason I assumed that I owned them is because BBC wasn't doing anything with them. And that's what stopped me from going any further. But I feel as time has gone by and technology has moved on, there's a certain element of fandom who's like, well, if you're not going to do it right, we're going to do it right. And I do feel that they do cross the line. And that's certainly when you think you're going to make money out of, in Axanar's case, by doing the Kickstarter and then making a studio that you then intend to use for other productions to rent to them, or that you're going to be making merchandise and selling it online, whether it be patches or models of the ship that, even though it's not the Enterprise, it's absolutely a Star Trek looking thing. You break those rules, which may not be in stone, but they are the same rules that has followed fandom for all this time. That if you take something from the people who make the thing that you love, you're stealing from them. And I that word stealing is very harsh, but it is a true word. You're taking something that does not belong to you. And that's where I stand on the Axanar thing. Not that I dislike anybody who was involved with it. Not that I dislike, you know, the Axamonitor people who are on one side with Carlos Pedraza, who was doing, I believe, a great job of putting facts down. And it's not just words. It's like he will state, like, here's a photograph of, like, this piece of documentation, and then he'll write about it. And it's not just all words thrown at the page, or I assume, or I think. It's actual documented stuff, and I respect that very much. And on the other side, you've got Alec and his team who are trying to protect what they've done and protect the Kickstarter money. But let's face it, the Kickstarter money, which is now like $1.1 million, because they haven't made anything for 2 years, that money's been spent on the studio and on props and costumes and people who got paid to do certain things, and that money's disappearing. And maybe even now that money may be half or even a quarter of what they need to make this thing, which the judge has said you've got every right to go ahead and make, but they have decided Axanar, you know, we aren't going to make this. And I believe the reason behind that is very, you know, if you give the judge and the other side, which is CBS and their legal team, more meat to grind you with, then you are going to be in trouble. So that's why I believe they haven't gone ahead and done what the judge has said. You've got every right to make Axanar. They have not done that past the 2 minutes of the Vulcan scene, which I showed Seth earlier, which was done as a taster of what they were capable of doing.
Well, so let me allow me to respond to some of that.
Sure.
I absolutely cannot disagree with you on any legal point. Again, you're absolutely right. If there's ever been a clear, clean and shut case of copyright infringement, it's this. I don't even know how to express it in any more stronger terms than that. I have no doubt about that. Now, why has some of this money been wasted? Well, because we're in a legal battle. Why haven't they made Axanar? Because it's not going to do much good to spend $1 million of people's money to make a film that no one can look at.
On the legal aspect, though, they are the Axanar has got a pro bono lawyer, Winston and Strawn, so they're not really spending any money on that.
Okay, I would love to see the finances. I don't really know, and I'm not using ignorance trying to use it as a benefit to my argument here. It's a detraction. I wish I knew. If this was some sort of scam, then they should litigate them, and people should get their money back. I would be completely on the side of that. But immaterial of that, I mean, I think part of the reason that Axanar hasn't been made has been because of ongoing legal action. I don't think it's any desire for people to not make the particular film, but making it and then sticking it in a can so no one can ever see it, or having it being seized by CBS and then burned out behind a studio, and $1 million worth of Kickstarter money evaporate in the cloud, which they would be then exposed to litigation for, is not a positive outcome for them either. So I can understand why they might be sitting on it, trying to do certain aspects of production, trying to pay people to keep them attached to the project. You know, I don't have the details on that, of course. You may know far more than I, my friend, on that. But I will say, though, that there's something to be said here. The fact is that we're not living in the era that you and I grew up in. This is an era where I can make better special effects than what things like Babylon 5 had, or even perhaps in some cases early episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, and I can do it on my MacBook laptop. So I think that we are entering an age where people can make reasonable special effected fan films that seem like they're set and feel like they're set much more, and you know, within the universes that they love. And you're right, as a product of intellectual property, this owned by, you know, Paramount, CBS. I again cannot dispute any of that. I really think though that this is, we're entering a disruptive phase where companies could look at newer, better ways to enjoy their copyright benefits by licensing these things out and making money off of these things. Now, what I disagree with you on is a couple points. Is I think part, and again, I don't know if I disagree. I guess maybe I should say that I feel strongly about is part of the reason that you're getting the outpouring in Star Trek, I would say probably as or more so than some of, I mean, you know, we're not seeing these less, and you guys would know better than I, again, that we're not seeing these kinds of fan films around, you know, or at this particular level, or some of the ones that we've seen before in Star Trek, that we're not seeing these out of the DC universe, or perhaps Star Wars, or Marvel. Maybe out of DC, I guess could counter my argument here, but is that Star Trek fans are really not happy with the state of Star Trek. I mean, look, Star Trek 2009 did moderately well. I think a lot of hardcore Star Trek fans went to that film and thought it was okay, that it might set up an interesting new universe, but they weren't thrilled. Star Trek Into Darkness, most Trekkers hated, and that's a conversation for another time. Beyond was a little bit better, but it wasn't good by any stretch of the imagination, and most Trekkers didn't like it. I refer to it derisively as the Trek and the Furious. And I think you have a pent-up demand in a fan base that has a lot of money, that has a lot of creativity, and they're telling Paramount. And then, you know, when Discovery got announced, there was a lot of excitement behind it because of Nicholas Meyer. But once more details leaked about it, people shrugged and said, this isn't great. I'm not happy with this. And I think the reason is you're seeing a lot of you have people that are very technically savvy, that have a decent amount of income, that are very creative, and quite frankly, they want to run their own baseball team. And I think Paramount would do better to make more money to get more excitement for Star Trek, which Beyond did not do great at the box office. It did probably well enough to get four from everything I've heard, but this is not a runaway break hit of the level of Force Awakens or, truthfully, even of things like Marvel's Ant-Man. So I think that's why you're seeing the kind of fan films and these sorts of things breaking away. You know, it kind of goes back to the early computer operating systems with Linus Torvalds creating Linux. Before that, you had things like Linux and some of these other new licensed operating systems we've heard, is that people are kind of getting, I think what could come out of this, maybe this is the best possible thing, is almost see a desire to move away from quote-unquote closed source science fiction, perhaps something of more of an open source, where people, maybe the internet needs to get together collectively to find a new science fiction universe that they can all open source and write their own stories within it. Maybe that's the better option. But I honestly don't think that you would have these sorts of fan films, this sort of excitement around the sort of Star Trek fan films, if Paramount was doing a better job delivering better product and creating better science fiction for a pent-up fan base that wants it.
I totally agree. But I'll also put this to you. You have a neighbor with a lemon tree, and you have access to no lemons. And those lemons on that tree are the tastiest, most wonderful lemons in the world. And you say to yourself, you know what? That neighbor in the past has thrown his baseball over here. His dog has pooped in my yard. I think he owes me something. So I'm going to put my hand over there and I'm going to grab hold of one of those lemons and I'm going to eat that lemon and I'm going to love that lemon. You know why? Because I love lemons and lemons are great. And if people put this lawsuit into that perspective, that I totally understand that your love for Star Trek, my love for Star Trek and Doctor Who and everything else is quantifiable. But CBS and Paramount really doesn't owe us anything because they have a product and they sell it to us. And of course, fans have saved Star Trek on a number of occasions. And yes, their Beyond movie was awful. I really didn't like the second one and very much didn't like the first. I think most fans would say, you know, they're 50-50 on it. But it does not give anyone the right to steal. And when you personalize it to something that you own, suddenly I think it's a lot easier to understand CBS Paramount. Because suddenly you're like, you're right, I don't own that. And even though I think I own it, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're 100% right. Again, I cannot retort in any way against anything you've said. The lemon tree analogy, you're right, they own it. But this is also a product that really only has value because the fans hung on to it after the three-year run, kept it going through all of the movies in the 80s, the 70s, of course, with Star Trek the Motion Picture, and really saved what was, in some regards, with, you know, general pop culture consciousness, a forgotten three-year show that was reasonably well-liked when it was on. And I think in this regard, you kind of, I would like to maybe make the metaphor of, you know, this is some multi-billionaire living in his tower up in the sky, lighting his cigars with $100 bills that he then sets on fire and throws out the window, and is, has a lemon tree and is prosecuting a 15-year-old kid who crossed over into his yard to steal a couple lemons to sell lemonade for 5 cents a piece at their lemonade stand on the corner. I think that's a little more apt metaphor for what's going on here.
But Abrams and Jay and Justin, they don't go out to make bad movies. I mean, Paramount doesn't put $100 million into a film and say, you know what, we are going to try and make the worst film we've ever done in our lives. I think they truly believe what they're doing.
I still stand by the metaphor of it being the, you know, multi-billionaire plutocrat lighting a cigar, burning $100 bills with his lemon tree. Like, I agree with you. I don't think they want to set out to make bad films.
So then you're Oprah Winfrey, because then I can say, you get a car, and you get a car, because then everybody has the right to go out there and make their own Star Trek film. And
well,
then
I would
be in a terrible situation, wouldn't we? Because there would be several bad ones, and there would be a few good ones, like Axanar. But what we do is, when we violate copyright, we say it's okay for everybody in every situation to find ways, like Winston and Strawn have done, to violate the copyright. And what they're doing right now with the lawsuit, which is amazing to me, they're not looking at the lemon tree situation. They're trying to stall Paramount with their latest thing, which is, we want to see all of the paperwork proving that CBS Paramount owned Star Trek all the way back the last 30 years. So they've just gone into a deposition situation where the judge has said, yes, you, CBS, you have to pull up all the paperwork now to prove that you own Star Trek. Because if you don't own Star Trek, then things like Axanar can happen. And it's just a delaying. It's just so ridiculous. It's a delaying tactic that everybody in the world knows. I don't care what you're gonna throw legal stuff at me. I don't care. CBS Paramount owns Star Trek. Of course they do.
Absolutely.
Can I ask a question then?
Yeah, I was going to ask for your input there, Train. Yeah, sorry.
I'm sure one of you knows. You keep saying the plaintiff is CBS Paramount, and I knew that they own the Star Trek property. Does Gene Roddenberry's estate not have any say in their intellectual property to Star Wars? Have they sold all those rights?
I believe they sold the rights. Yeah. Gene was very much for fan stuff. He let people write fanzines.
Well, I know that, but what I'm saying is,
but CBS Paramount, you know, they're gonna, I don't care what anybody would tell me at this point. Of course they own Star Trek. They've owned Star Trek since almost, you know, Star Trek was on the air.
I think to your question, Train, I believe the Roddenberrys and Majel Barrett, who passed away, have long since, you know, families or children. This is a very good question. I wish I knew, but I believe that by this point, I think it's all been owned by CBS Paramount.
Right.
And to the other point, if I was the judge hearing this case, I would absolutely immediately summarily rule in favor of CBS Paramount. I want to make sure that I'm clear on that. That said, my frustration with it is the fact that Paramount and CBS own something that's largely been because the fans have stuck with it.
Can I speak to that? I'm going to look at this from a different perspective because it's the business that I know, and it's professional wrestling, which is, like all the things we talk about here, has ardent base fan base that, you know, this and that and the other. I think I saw as a professional wrestler, and I see it now, even though I'm retired, fans of any particular form of entertainment or franchise, like we're talking about, have a sense of ownership. And you are correct, Will. In today's day and age, the technological breakthroughs we have, some of those fan bases are able to create some of the things that they like and that they're a fan of, sometimes as good or better than, you know, the leading producer of that type of entertainment. This is not uncommon in wrestling. We've had this for a lot of years. And what I always would say as a wrestler would tell you when they would, people would complain about, well, I don't like what's happening on this national promotion or this national promotion. Well, then why don't you get you a, buy you a ring, hire you some wrestlers and a ref, and run your own shows? And I'm fine with that. And the difference though between that and what we're talking about is they go out and run their own shows. They have their own federation name. They have their own titles. It's their intellectual property. Yes, they were inspired by Vince McMahon, the WWE, or by the NWA, or the old WCW, but they're not trying to copy it. You know, it's to me, it's, you used a sport analogy you used. It was no different than the old USFL from when we were kids in the 80s. They weren't trying to be the NFL. They were trying to be competition to the NFL, but it was, everybody has that right to go out and do that kind of stuff. But I totally agree with what all of you are saying. Star Trek itself is the intellectual property of Paramount. And I don't see where Axanar is has a leg to stand on, because I agree with Seth. Me and Seth are talking about this off mic. I was a writer. I was an English major in college, and I'm a musician. So I understand a lot about intellectual property. And it just is what it is. And if you have something that you create, you either go out and bust your ass and sell it yourself and make a profit, or you sell it to somebody else who can. That is why movie studios exist, television studios exist, publishing houses, because there are creative people that don't have the means to get their intellectual property to a large audience. And so they sell part of that right to these said companies who can take it much farther than they can. That's what Gene Roddenberry did, you know, way back when with Star Trek stuff. And I don't understand why fans think they have a right to... You have every right in the world to be creative. You have every right in the world. But once you start making a profit off of it, you're stealing. I agree with the lemon tree analogy. And no offense to you, Will. That's a very, you know, noble mindset. The rich guy, he's trying to sue the 15-year-old kid. Yeah, it's stupid. But he has that right. I mean, if he wants to burn $100 bills, he earned it. It's his right. And if he wants to be a jackass and sue the kid who's stealing from him something he's never going to lose, though it's morally questionable, he's... Legally, he's right. He can. And so...
No, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, Treen, at all. I've been agreeing with both of you. I just think that...
If I can butt in here, Will, if I understand where you're coming from, you're kind of taking it as more like where the fan might see it. You know, because there are some people who are siding with... Axanar, and that's part of the thing, is, oh, they're suing the fans, and they're trying to keep the fans from having their fun. You know, when they have all this money at their disposal.
Right.
Yeah, I also think, though, that we're starting to get to the point where you see this a lot, again, and I'm going to say it with sports franchises, because I think the only thing comparable to science fiction, fantasy, sort of, you know, fans, like is sports fans. I think that kind of ownership and that kind of fanaticism between sports and science fiction fantasy is very similar. And you know, my college football team that I love is Purdue Boilermakers. They've been really bad. They've taken fan money and, you know, not rewarding us with anything. And I stopped donating, stopped going to games, encouraged my other friends to, and we all did. And, you know, the attendance in the theater, the attendance in the stadium dropped from 70,000 a game to about 27,000 a game. And they finally fired the coach and got an athletic director and are trying to turn it around. And I mean, you know, I get kind of cranky. I'm sure most of you guys do, when we constantly hear about boycott, with whether it be one of many different economic or political reasons. But I mean, I think that if this kind of behavior keeps going, what you're going to see is the fans, maybe some of them will stay away. Maybe Star Trek 4 makes less than beyond. Maybe Discovery reach a fan base. And I think that's, you know, to your point about the lemon tree, like, you're right. I don't dispute any of it, but it's a jerk move, right? And I think that you see some of the things that are going on here, and I think lack of ability for Paramount, which really holds more of the cards, to trying to find more of an acceptable solution and even a profitable solution where they can make some more money. I think when you look at the way that they've conducted themselves with this, and I think you look at the fact that they're not delivering what the fan base wants, and I think you look at a lot of this, what may end up happening, and it's really more the true way to go, is fans stay away, let it crumble and burn, and maybe they'll reburn Rome or build Rome again. From ashes, better than what it was before. And maybe that's the only thing.
I love analogies, so I'm going to go to another analogy because the lemon tree was so successful. Thank you. There's a spaceship going through space. Let's call it the Starship Enterprise. Oh, can't use that. Let's call it Acheron. Oh, no, can't use that. That's from Alien. Let's call it the Starship Hisnib. And it's led by the captain, Sheba Juba Juba. And it's suddenly been attacked by a Moogar. Well, nobody's going to watch that because nobody cares. And that's why people latch on to IP. And that's why people have latched on to Star Trek. Because there's a recognizable thing all the way back to T-shirts, where the T-shirt was like Igrok Spock and stuff that was never licensed and all that. It's something, and I think Axanar grabbed a hold of this. There's a fan base that they can make money on. They'll deny that they were trying to make Axanar to make money. But at the end of the day,
I do deny that. There's a difference between it trying to be an entirely purely capitalistic endeavor and also trying to be a creative one at the same time. Like, I have no doubt they were trying to make money, but I don't think that that was maybe perhaps necessarily the primary driver of the creation of Axanar.
And that's what, you know, what side of this argument you're on is pretty much whether they're trying to make money, I feel, or whether, you know, they were doing it for the love of fandom. And I think
it can be both.
It can be both, but it's almost like the current election with Trump and Clinton. There's nobody really in the middle. Either you're for or you're against. And if you
I'm against both voting for Gary Johnson.
If you look at what's actually occurred with the Facebook groups, you've got the Axanar fan group of about 1,400 people on Facebook, and then you've got the CBS versus Axanar with about 950 people, and both sides are pretty much doing what's happening in this election. Something comes up, it's deny. Something comes up, it's attack. It's mirroring this election absolutely. It's just so fascinating to see both sides go at it. And then occasionally you see the odd person defect. And typically they're not defecting from the non-pro side. They're defecting from the pro to the non-side. So that's got to tell you something. There is a certain amount of people who are slowly but surely starting to see that there are some cracks in the good ship Axanar.
Well, you know, you're right, Mark, about the whole analogy with the I can't name it this, I can't name it that. That was kind of my point is, if you're a creative person and you're inspired by Star Trek, go ahead, make something. Just don't make it Star Trek.
Make Galaxy Quest. Because Galaxy Quest was Star Trek without ripping off Star Trek.
Right. And like you said, the reason they cling to this is because it's identifiable. And so thus marketable, which that kind of does lead credence to the argument that they were trying to make a buck off this. You know, this is not just purely about fandom. Because, I mean, before Roddenberry created the Federation of the Klingons, nobody heard of them. Before Lucas created the Empire and the Rebellion, nobody'd heard of them. Or any other franchise you want to throw out there. You know, all of you guys know I'm a huge John Carpenter fan. He was asked one time what he thought about remakes. And, you know, like the J.J. Abrams stuff was essentially a reboot or a remake. And his point was very valid. He goes, look, I'm not saying I'm a former or I'm against them. And I think he has a dog in the fight because he is a, you know, Hollywood royalty who makes his money off of, you know, making movies and music for movies and has worked with these big studios. When he said the studios from a monetary standpoint are going to protect their properties and are going and sometimes will protect them by making reboots or remakes because it's just easy to market. There's already a fan base involved or at least a familiarity. It's just as a creative person, it bothered him the way he was talking in this interview. But he also understood from as a businessman why it was done. And I think that's kind of the gray area that we're at right now is, like you said, is it purely for fandom? Is it purely for profit? It's probably a little bit of both.
I think the gray area has been created just as a mist to confuse and confound people. Because
I agree.
We all know the truth that when you steal, you're doing something wrong.
Right, exactly.
The way you justify it is you say, well, I needed bread because I was hungry and I was starving. It's still a generally considered notion that you don't steal.
Right. And I think that you know, that's legalese. That's the American legal system. Right or wrong, it just is what it is. And so I can't say I'm shocked on every point thrown out by one side's legal team and then the counter from the other side's legal team. Because that's just what lawyers do.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I think, though, when you start looking at this, though, there's a prime. Well, so I think that you can, you know, okay, so stealing is a morally objectionable act. I can agree with that. But in certain situations, I would argue it's a lesser objectionable act than someone losing a life. Now, clearly, copyright infringement on Axanar doesn't fall into that kind of gray area.
No.
And I've told you multiple times, again, that if I was the judge, I would summarily rule in favor of Paramount CBS while telling them they're a bunch of jerks. But I think what's starting to happen within fandom, and I think you've seen it in several different aspects of fandom, some of them I don't want to get, you know, distracted by or bring up here, but the fans are starting to push back. We feel that there's a lot of fans that feel like they do have a certain ownership of some of this because they've been good consumers, they love it, it's something they participated in, and comic, you know, comic cons and cosplay, all of this, and they do feel a personal ownership of it. And I think you guys are taking a very inside baseball sort of, and it's not wrong, sort of stance on this, but I think that the emotional stance by a lot of fans in this regard, because remember, that $1 million came from fans, okay?
But they knew what they were getting into when they invested it.
Oh, no, I know that, but that's not the point.
Well, they didn't, though, because...
believed in it because they wanted to see it and because they thought that it looked like something that they would be interested in as fans of Star Trek. And I think what we're rapidly getting into is a sort of mentality, and it's what's probably going to win. And like I said, as a capitalist, I think there's a winnable situation here for both that neither party is interested in. But I think that there's, you know, a lot of, I think, breaking down to what you guys think is, as a fan, sit down, shut up, consume, or get out of the theater and don't participate.
Because that's the best way you can speak as a consumer.
I agree.
Wrong. That was my Trump moment. That was my Trump moment. Wrong.
Well, that's always been my thing. When
you're
I
not wrong. I'm just saying that because I just felt like interjecting.
when I go on the A1 podcast, you can ask the wrestling podcast. You can ask Seth. Often when we get all these complaints, my response to the fandom as a guy who made a living from the wrestling business was, you're unhappy. Don't watch. You got an on-off button on your television. That's the best way you can respond and precipitate change by those who are in control. And then my follow up to that is always, and if you don't like it, go out and get your own ring and run your own wrestling show.
And about my
lemon tree, I'm going to build a wall and it's going to be 20 feet higher because you people are all coming after my lemons. I can see that.
Isn't it funny?
When I was talking about the billionaire plutocrat lighting his cigar with a $100 bill in his tower, I assume you were thinking of the same person I was thinking of.
I don't know why I was thinking.
We have the British guy making the commentary on American politics. I'm just, you know.
But you were talking about something I want to bring up here, very, very important. About the fans knowing what they were in for. Well, the truth is the fans assumed that CBS had given the green light to all this. In fact, some of the interviews that were done were kind of like, well, CBS has sort of given us a blessing. But the truth is that Paramount had always said, we can't tell you what to do. And there was always an air of, you shouldn't really be doing this.
Well, then that's the fault of both sides. That's the fault of CBS Paramount for not being more explicit in where they stood on this before these people invested their money. And then it's also on the Axanar team for being a bit of a obfuscation on their part, not being full. So that's two, you know, and are we shocked that a bunch of money hungry people who are in this to make money, which is both sides, are lying to the people who they're trying to get money from? No, that's
the difference with the two sides on Axanar versus say something like Star Trek Continues. Star Trek Continues paid their people, you know, money to like their like car driving. I think maybe they might have bought people lunch. But with Axanar, certain people were paid, you know, $10,000-$20,000 for this.
Yeah, where they were paid professionally.
Alex Peters,
basically,
the producer, took a $40,000 wage salary for the year. And that's the thing that caused Paramount to say, hang on, this isn't what we wanted or what we were trying to say. And you're right, they should have come up and been more clean cut. But the problem is when you do that, when you put an expectation, a barrier in, you do cause so many other problems. And so you really can't have one or the other. It's like me letting you have one lemon off my tree and then the next day saying, no, you can't have another one. It's confusing.
I still think there's the idea that they could come in and arrange something along the lines, like I said, of owning 80% of profits from fan films. If they were to go that direction, promote them on StarTrek.com, sell them, and turn a tidy profit off of them having to do no effort and take extra money. And I think that's the Steve Jobs, quote-unquote, Apple sort of approach to this. It's a very new media approach, which I think would benefit both parties. It would increase interest in Trek.
But they didn't. and that's where I stand on the other side of fandom from you, is that they never said you could, but they never said you could. So basically they said no. And I think that's really where I stand on
you. I'm just saying that I don't think that they're necessarily, I think that they perhaps might be a little bit short-sighted rather than thinking of better ways to exploit their own intellectual property.
Well, we know this because this is the company that allowed stupid things to happen, like burning sets off the Enterprise and then a year later selling all the props and costumes for millions of dollars. Yeah. I mean, they don't get it. They don't understand that when you make Star Trek, and I said this to several people over the years about Doctor Who, one of the ways you finance Doctor Who is that you sell all the props and costumes ahead of making the show. You give them to the fans, like on a Kickstarter way, and then, you know, you've already paid $150,000 of whatever you're making just by selling the extra stunt costumes and extra sonic screwdrivers. And none of these companies understand that there's a huge amount of money to be made out of the production process, even down to, say, you have a day when you invite the fans down, they come and watch the filming, and you've got $10,000 from some rich fan. There are so many ways to make money out of sci-fi TV and movies, and that, the problem is, you're right, the studios are so short-sighted, they don't see these things until basically someone else does it and they go, well, hang on, we should be doing that, and then suddenly it's okay for them to come in.
Doesn't it blow your mind a corporation that big that's all about making money has not figured out how to maximize their monetization process? That's
just amazing. It completely blows my mind. I remember when there was a TV show called Spitting Image in England, and it was all about rubber puppets of the politicians. I went to them in 91, maybe 2 years after the show had ended, and I said, you probably got all the company was called Luck and Floor, or Fluck and Law, or something like that. Some weird name that sounded really dirty, but wasn't. Roger Law and David Fluck, I think. So I went to him and said, look, you got all these puppets, I would love to buy them. And they were blah, no, can't redo that, you know. So then, like, 3 years later, suddenly they had to actually pay storage on the place where all the puppets were, and they ended up in Sotheby's and sold for thousands of dollars. But the condition by then of these puppets was that, you know, they were half as good as they were 3 years before, when they would have made even more money. So I was so ahead of my time.
But yeah, that's always the issue, though. It's capitalism. It's you know, law. It's demand for things. And look at, like, the speculation boom of comic books in the 90s and how that bubble burst. I think a lot of these companies that we're talking about, that we're laughing at because they're not monetizing what they could be monetizing, they're not. They probably do know the market out there for this stuff, but they also realize it's a very fickle market. And yes, this could sell for $1 million. But can we find that one fan who's willing to buy it for $1 million? No. And if not, we're sitting on it and it's taking up space and we're having to pay for storage. So sometimes it's just more cost effective to destroy it, I think.
Do you remember, like, I was a huge David Letterman fan throughout his run, mostly his NBC run, but even the CBS. And after he recorded his last show, they literally took the entire New York cityscape behind David Letterman and threw it in a dumpster.
Uh-huh.
It was picked up out of there, and I think it sold for somewhere along the lines of $38,000 to $44,000 on eBay.
There were lots of pieces in that dumpster, I'll put it like that. But but they did monetize the costumes. They put them in an auction about a month ago, but they didn't have anybody who actually went through and, like, listed where the costumes were used. It was an underseen site where they sold them. So the stuff went for maybe 1/10 of what it could be. So that was just another example of a company that totally, you know, the seats, they tore the seats out and threw them in the dumpster. People would have paid $300, $400, $500 a seat, maybe even $1,000 a seat before the show was cancelled. But when you sell something a year later, nobody cares. The interest is not there. And so many of these companies that do sell stuff on eBay or Sotheby's and Christie's, you know, they're selling this stuff so late that nobody gives a damn.
Let me give you a great example of the gray area on the stuff we're talking about, and it is also pro wrestling related. When Jim Crockett Promotions, which was the main competitor to Vince McMahon in the 80s, had monetary trouble, he sold to Ted Turner and Turner Broadcasting in 1989.
Yep.
One of his former employees was a manager named Jim Cornette, who's a friend of mine, and is very successful now with his own wrestling podcast and doing the cons. We're talking about the wrestling conventions and, you know, speaking engagements and autograph sessions. Well, he let it be known to the people there at Crockett's office building, if they throw anything out when the Turner people show up, call me and let me know. He actually got a call from the janitor. He said, well, they just came and they left a whole bunch of stuff out here by the dumpster. You want to come get it?
That's how it happens.
And he said, grab it. So Cornette goes down there and grabs it. He finds it. Turner either didn't know what it was worth or didn't want it anymore because they had thrown it out. And
they didn't
it wound up being hundreds of hours of stuff from the 70s, the reel-to-reel films of old shows, some of them without commentary because they were just filmed there at for that local market, and posters and programs. Well, he has taken the time on his own to convert those to VCR because that's what the technology at the time in the 90s, and has recently converted them to DVD, compiled them, written the liner notes himself, paid the money to have all the packaging done, and is now selling them on his website and making a lot of money. I own one. And he was kind of worried about what Vince McMahon was going to do because sequentially Vince McMahon bought WCW. So he owns all their, technically, legally, he owns all their back library. And Vince's take on it was, well, yeah, we do, but they threw it out, so I don't have a leg to stand on. Once it went to the garbage can, it's gone. So what I bought is I bought stuff from Turner, and since Turner didn't claim it, Turner's the one that would have to go after him. And so you're right, that kind of stuff does happen. And there's an example of a guy who probably is somebody else's intellectual property, but the person who has the intellectual property, they're not fighting him, and they're letting him make a profit off of it. So
yeah,
and we as wrestling fans are benefiting from it. So hey,
yeah, I think to kind of get it back, turn it back around. I'd heard the stories of models of the Enterprise that were used in the original show, and fans had picked them up because they'd been thrown out. I think the Death Star that was the half completed Death Star that was used in Return of the Jedi was thrown out, and now it's at a bar somewhere.
You talking about like the model they use for the special effect shots?
Yeah.
Okay.
The actually what that is you've got it kind of half right. That was the Star Wars Death Star, the original one. ILM had it in a warehouse back in the 80s, and then that warehouse had been sold. So a junk shop ended up getting it, and a couple of guys went in there and bought it for, I think it was quite a lot of money at the time, maybe $10,000 or something. And then a gentleman called Gus Lopez, who's a very, very famous Star Wars collector, bought that off them, and he now has it in a glass case in his front room, and it's, that thing is worth $1 million.
Probably literally, yeah.
And the only
yeah.
thing it was missing was the radar dish, the beam dish on the front. Mm-hmm. And it still had all of the lighting, I think, inside, and it's got on a beautiful black sea stand now, so it stands in his living room. But yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of something that today, Lucasfilm could have a $1 million prop on their books, and, they just let it go.
But to steer it back to Star Trek, I think we're mostly on the same page here. I think we do have to wind things up here because we're starting to run out of time. We all agree to some extent as far as the legality of what you can and can't do, right?
Keep the hell away from my lemons.
And I think we all also agree, Seth, that it kind of sucks, but the system is what the system is.
And whereabouts on the lawsuit right now? Any of you guys know where we are with it?
Well, the other day, I know that they just won the air. I actually looked at the Axnar blog before we came on here today. And my cursory little glance of it is that motion that they filed to make Paramount CBS prove that they own Star Trek, they upheld Axnar's side on that, and they'll have to do discovery.
In other words, a delaying tactic, in other words.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And the band keeps playing on, in other words.
Right. So I'll just put this way. In this fight, I look at CBS and Paramount as the empire, and I'm solidly on Axnar's rebel side. But
we know where legally this is going to end, though, don't we?
Oh, Axnar's going to lose this, absolutely. There's no way they can win this legal system. And like I said, if I was ruling on this case, I'd rule against them. I wouldn't even let it get this far.
Yep. Can I add something real quick? You said, there's a way to do this and balance it, like, yeah, you win, but you're a jerk. There is precedent for that, Will. Go back to my USFL analogy I made earlier. The USFL sued the NFL for monopoly, for monopolizing professional football in the United States. And it was a long, drawn-out case similar to this, where there was a lot of legal stuff on both sides. And when all was said and done, the USFL actually won. And the judge granted them $1 in damages.
Yeah.
So there is precedent for the type of ruling you're talking about.
Well, one of the complaints that people have had is that, you know, they couldn't get their Kickstarter money back because it seemed like, you know, the money was either spent. But Axnar has just recently started offering refunds to people as long as you sign a rather lengthy piece of paper basically saying that you won't attack Axnar online or in any form of communication. And it's funny, really, that, you know, only certain people who have been very vocal seem to be getting these refunds. So
wow, that's almost like a new school NDA then, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, that is kind of telling. You don't really do that unless you've got something to hide or you don't want people talking about you because I don't know. I think that was a mistake. And the simple fact of the matter is that refunds should just have been given and just... If they've got the money, but you got to remember they've been paying for studio space and for keeping the company open now for, you know, some time. So the question is, the big question, which we may not know until deep into, well, we may never know. They might not even let us know during the judging, you know, how much money is left in the kitty.
Well, I have a feeling that once Axnar loses this lawsuit, there will be a class action suit against Axnar. And then at that point, the books will get opened. And then they will, of course, if you know anything about how law works in America, at least financial law, the largest debtors are the ones who get paid first. And then individually, you move down the food chain to smaller and smaller fish. So as time goes on, I don't know what kind of other contracts they have with set building company, unions, whatever. They're going to be paid first, and then it will come to, you know, the fans to get paid back.
Well, right. The guys went out of business in 2009, and they left pretty much $400,000 to $500,000 of debting behind them. So, and that was all run by the same guy. So the question is, you know, is there anything left or not? And I got a sneaking suspicion that there might not be very much left on the table.
All right. So to wind things up here, anything you have to say in closing there, Train?
No, just I repeat what I said before about anything. If you think you can do it better or you feel you have emotional ownership to something, you have every right to go out and be creative. But you can't step on other people's toes for what they already own. Do it better. If you've got why you got to call them Vulcans in the Enterprise is what I'm saying. Create your own sci-fi world. And if not, realize this probably is going to happen. So, but I am intrigued by Will's thoughts on what seems like almost franchising it out. That has merit and maybe discussion for another podcast.
Yeah. Just one last thing, which is, you know, I mean, for years, these franchises have encouraged active participation, fans to be part of it, to feel like they're part of it, to dress as it, to make, you know, smaller fan films. And I think as technology has evolved, I think that fans have tried to become even more part of it. And I think that what's going to happen is that when fans have a lot of opinions about how their favorite sci-fi, fantasy, what have you, is being run, and it's not being run to their particular level of standards, I think you're going to continue to see things like this begin to blow up and emerge. I think this is kind of the beginning of something, not necessarily the end of it. And even though absolutely Paramount CBS is 100% legally correct, I do want to stress that when they win this case, and it's a matter of when, not a matter of if, when they win it, don't be surprised if a lot more Trekkers begin to feel themselves distancing from this particular franchise and begin to perhaps take more of a economic boycott sort of approach to the things that they feel are not being done right or to their standards.
Wow, that's been a heck of a discussion going on here. It's fascinating, really, on all aspects. And I, before we close up here, I do want to remind you about our affiliate Amazon. You can go to a1-wrestling.com/Amazon. And shop Amazon to your heart's content. We do get a little bit of kickback from that, but it's no cost to you. Nothing. There's no commitments. There's no surprises. No extra cost We're just asking that if you're going to use Amazon anyway, just use our link, a1-wrestling.com/Amazon, and we do get a little bit of kickback from whatever you purchase. And we also have an affiliate with Audible. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/A1, pick up a free audiobook of your choosing with a risk-free 30-day trial. It can be Star Trek. It can be a Star Wars book. They got full cast audio dramas. Or you can get anything nonfiction or a biography. Anything in their 150,000-plus library is available for a risk-free trial of one book at audiblepodcast.com/A1. Mark, if anybody wants to talk to you about your lemons, is there any way people can get a hold of you online, or is it's mainly propstop.com?
Yeah, right? Just go to propstop.wordpress.com.
And Train, if anybody wants to yell at you, you're always available at crazytrain_JB on Twitter, correct?
All the time, ladies and gentlemen, all the time.
And Will, I'm giving you the last word. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, you can be reached on Twitter as well, right?
Absolutely. Will Mortal on Twitter, last name MORTL.
And once again, you can follow the show notes at geekvilleradio.com. You can find us on Facebook at A1Geekville and on Twitter at A1Geekville. Thanks to you folks for listening. We definitely had a supersized show. I think we had some spirited discussion, a little bit of controversy. Let us know what you think. You let us know on Twitter or on Facebook, or I can be reached at seth@a1-wrestling.com. We are available on iTunes. You can just hit that subscribe button on iTunes and give us some feedback. Let us know what you think on iTunes. Give us a review. We love hearing feedback, especially when it's genuine, good, bad. If it's genuine, we definitely want to hear from you. We will talk to you folks again next week.
The Geekville Podcast is not sponsored or endorsed by any of the companies or products discussed unless specifically stated. The views expressed by the hosts and or guests are purely their own and do not represent the views of any sponsors, A1-Wrestling.com, or its affiliates. Music written and performed by Kevin MacLeod can be found at incomptech.com.
You notice one thing about Mark being on this show is we didn't have to worry about making the obligatory Doctor Who reference this episode.
Not at all. kind of just happens.
I'm sure there's a reference in somewhere in Doctor Who to a damn lemon tree.